reflexión. Si quiere conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer los caminos del Che,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere trabajar en la caña de azúcar,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
En un barquito se va al vaivén,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer a Martí y a Fidel,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere conocer los caminos del Che,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere tomar ron pero sin Coca-Cola,
hasta Cuba, hasta Cuba, yo Cuba iré.
Si quiere trabajar en la caña de azúcar.
¡Patria libre! ¡Patria libre! ¡Patria o muerte! ¡Venceremos!
¡Adelante, marchemos, compañeros! ¡Avancemos a la revolución! ¡Nuestro pueblo es el dueño de su historia! ¡Arquitecto de su liberación!
Sandino, ni se rinde, luchamos contra el yanque, enemigo de la humanidad.
Revolución o muerte venceremos. El FMLN, vanguardia de un pueblo que lucha, será el que nos guiará a la victoria final. Hermanos unidos para combatir, avancemos a la revolución. Construyamos un futuro de progreso y dignidad. Revolución o muerte venceremos. Farabundo Martí nos inspiró y hoy resurge victorioso en nuestra frente. La bandera roja y blanca nos protegerá y una estrella el sendero nos señalará.
Farabundo Martí viene rompiendo caminos libertarios por donde transitará la paz y la justicia de nuestro pueblo.
Hermanos unidos para combatir, avancemos a la revolución, construyamos un futuro de progreso y dignidad. Revolución o muerte venceremos. Revolución o muerte venceremos.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and I just pretty much played a bit of a medley there of first we started out with the an anthem from the PSOV, the Partido Socialista Unido de Venezuela. And we had a song by Victor Jara called A Cuba, which of course celebrates the Cuban Revolution. And we had a song from the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and the National Liberation Front there, which of course, very recently we had the anniversary of the, I believe it was 1979, when of course the U.S.-backed government dictatorship brutal dictatorship. Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua was overthrown by the Sandinistas. You had the Sandinista Revolution. And then, of course, you had the Himno de FMLN, which, of course, is from the Liberation Front of El Salvador. And I think that goes to show that those songs just go to show how strong the revolutionary tradition is in that part of the world, in Latin America, and how basically no fascist-minded government or fascist-minded individuals can smash that or take it away. The people there really have risen. They continue to rise, you know, all over that region, you know, rising up with dignity and with bravery. In Venezuela, what's going on in Venezuela right now is where, of course, they're about to have the Constituent Assembly and rewrite the Constitution and go towards socialism. That's part of that. Now, I'm going to take another short break, and then I'm going to be back, and we're going to talk about Syria and and the United States and Russia and these other issues, which I said I was going to talk about earlier. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Hi, my name is Kevin, and back in the 80s, I used to hang around CFRU all the time. Anyone can volunteer here. Just email volunteer@cfru.ca or visit cfru.ca for more information.
Guelph Black Heritage Society is excited to present the Emancipation Day Jamboree, taking place Saturday, July the 29th. Bring the entire family to Heritage Hall at 83 Essex Street in downtown Guelph from 2 to 7 p.m. for an afternoon of live music, cultural foods, dance, face painting, games, and more. This will be the GBHS's fifth Emancipation Day celebration, observed to commemorate the emancipation of enslaved people of African descent. There is a suggested donation of $5, and all proceeds will go towards the ongoing Ramping It Up campaign to make Heritage Hall a physically accessible location. For more info, visit guelphblackheritage.ca. That's the Guelph Black Heritage Society's Emancipation Day Jamboree, Saturday, July 29th, in the backyard of Heritage Hall, a physically accessible location.
Lead your ears astray with Oral Tethers, Friday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight, with your host, Hymns 57. Delving into field recordings, found sound, avant-garde, experimental, electronic, and otherworldly soundscapes designed to lead your ears astray, only on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
For the second year, Frontier College Guelph will be running Guelph Exploration Club, a fun, free day camp for new immigrant and Arabic-speaking children ages 6 to 12. This dual-language club aims to help new Canadian children improve their literacy in English, prepare for the upcoming school year, and make new friends. The club runs July 31st to August 4th, 8:30 to 4:30 at Gateway Public School, 33 Gateway Drive in Guelph. We are physically accessible and free. You can contact Erica Woodford at Frontier College for more information at ewoodford@frontiercollege.ca. You can also find us on Facebook, Frontier College Guelph, or just Google Guelph Exploration Club for our registration page. Hope to see you there.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU, and of course I've been talking about what's going on in Latin America and the struggle against imperialism there, but of course I said I was going to talk about what's going on in Syria as well and a few other things at the beginning of the show. And really, of course, Syria is almost the penultimate struggle against imperialism in the world today. I mean, this, of course, is a country that has been brutalized for the last 6 years, invaded, very, very, very publicly, the U.S. has basically tried to dismember it, and U.S. allies in the region have tried to dismember it, whether that's Saudi Arabia or Qatar, or, Turkey or Israel. basically tried to occupy areas of the country, used their proxy forces to occupy the areas of the country, funnel all kinds of arms, training, massive amounts of funding going towards various militant groups, you know, basically very much right-wing, reactionary, outright fascist military groups, you know, with, in a case of theocratic motivations, setting up, trying to set up like theocratic government in Syria and this sort of thing. I mean, this is the, you know, and this isn't, we're not even just talking about ISIS here. We're talking about all kinds of different groups, whether Ahrar al-Sham or, HTS, the, which is the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda wing in Syria, and all these different groups, which are currently devastating the country. All these groups are foreign funded, foreign backed. And, you know, and of course, like U.S. forces are now on the ground in Syria. I think they have about 11 bases now in the north of the country and in the south of the country. And yet they keep getting on Russia's case because the Syrian government invited Russia to establish two military bases in the country. And the U.S. went and illegally basically colonized areas of the country and set up about 11 military bases, and there's plans for more. This is the kind of thing that's going on there. Of course, that's not what you get in the mainstream media. You certainly don't hear about the heroic struggle of the of the Syrian people and the Syrian army to liberate their land, to free their land, to drive out these forces which are tearing it apart, and really fight against you know, imperialism of the worst kind, which is being visited upon them. This is the thing you don't hear about, and of course the successes that they're winning. I mean, they've made massive progress over the last year in terms of you know, driving out these various terrorist groups and you know, foreign-backed terrorist groups, driving them out of the country and defeating them, and you know, they're winning all kinds of victories every day, it seems, hard-fought victories. So what I thought I'd play here today is Max Blumenthal, who's been a very excellent journalist covering the struggle in Syria, the struggle against imperialism in Syria. This is a talk he gave recently on the Real News Network about the how the media, the Western media, covers Syria, and he really dissected that, and he really analyzed it and talked about the you know, the pro-imperialist agenda, which you really get in the mainstream media in places like the U.S., in Canada, in the U.K. and whatnot. So this is what he had to say, and it's you know, I found this his analysis to be absolutely amazing. So I'll play that right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. This is part two of my discussion with Max Blumenthal, best-selling author, journalist, and senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. In part one, we talked about Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin's meeting at the G20. Despite agreeing on a ceasefire in southwestern Syria, most U.S. media is focusing on Putin and Trump's talks about alleged Russian meddling in the U.S. election. Well, in this part, Max and I discuss how the media is covering Syria. You know, Max, since we're talking about Syria, I want to ask you about a piece you just wrote for Alternet along with Ben Norton up at Alternet's Gray Zone Project. It's about Bilal Abdul Karim, who is an American who's been embedded with rebel groups inside Syria. And he recently worked with CNN on a documentary. But afterwards, they apparently made an effort to distance themselves from him. And he recently complained about that in a Twitter video. So let's go to that clip.
You know, there was a piece that I did along with the other members of OGN staff called Undercover in Syria. This was with CNN and their correspondent, Clarissa Ward, which I have big time respect for, big time respect as a journalist and as a person. Now, this Undercover in Syria, and you can Google it, it won the prestigious Peabody Award, and it won the prestigious Overseas Press Club Award, which are basically the highest awards in journalism for international reporting. Now, they barely mentioned my name. I'm telling you, somehow CNN must have forgotten that I was the one that filmed it. I guess they forgot that.
So that's Bilal Abdul Karim. Max, talk about who he is and what he's complaining about here.
Well, Bilal Abdul Karim is right. CNN is seeking, it's not really distancing itself from him. It's just seeking to erase the role it played the role he played in its award-winning Undercover in Syria special, which was filmed in 2016. Clarissa Ward, the star CNN correspondent who just gets award after award from these corporate industry organizations. She got a Peabody Award for that special. Contracted Bilal Abdul-Karim. And she should have known, and everybody knows who follows Syria, that Bilal Abdul-Karim is a propagandist for al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra. And if you watch his videos, you'll see him having friendly sit-down chats with Abdullah Mohseni, the Saudi hate preacher and warlord, who's the most influential cleric inside al-Qaeda-controlled territory in Syria. And this guy raises millions of dollars for al-Qaeda-led offensives against the Syrian government. He has... we revealed, Ben Norton and I at Alternet, that it appears that Bilal Abdul-Karim was working behind the scenes to produce propaganda for Jaish al-Fatah, which is a coalition led by al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate. So he was, you know, he directly kind of had his hands on the propaganda steering wheel. And then there's the issue of whether he's even a member of al-Nusra, as the Saudi state organ Al Arabiya reported. I mean, I don't really trust their credibility that much, but Akif Razak, who is a colleague of Bilal Abdul-Karim and is from Britain, these guys seem to think, like Bilal, who's an American, that they have a right to go to Syria and promote rebels who are running rampant across the country and committing atrocities. They have some kind of right to be there. But this character, Akif Razak, just had his citizenship stripped by the British government, which has accused him of membership in al-Qaeda. It's really clear that Bilal Abdul-Karim has a very friendly relationship with al-Qaeda in Syria. He works hand in glove with them inside their territories, along with Salafist militias like Ahrar al-Sham. And he is the man that Clarissa Ward chose to contract as her videographer and kind of fixer when she went in. And she went in at a time when no other Western journalists had come in. I mean, we'd seen James Foley beheaded by ISIS after getting traded around by a kidnapping ring that involved some British foreign fighters. We published a piece at Alternet by Lindsay Snell, who was one of the last journalists to go into al-Qaeda-controlled territory before getting kidnapped. Clarissa Ward was able to move freely there, came back with another commercial for the Syrian armed opposition. This is what she's been doing year after year. And then she testified before the UN at the invitation of Samantha Power, the most strongly interventionist voice in the Obama administration, and proclaimed that the Islamist militias inside Syria are, in her words, the heroes on the ground. I mean, it was just straightforward advocacy, but it's also well in line with the editorial line of CNN that we see every day on Jake Tapper's The Lead. So this isn't even treated as a scandal.
Max, let's connect this to Western policy. You have this major U.S. media outlet, CNN, working with someone who you say sympathizes with al-Qaeda and might even be working with them directly. At the same time, you've had this criticism of U.S. policy in Syria that either, you know, through sending weapons to militant groups and also through partnership with its Gulf allies, it's directly and indirectly supported jihadist groups inside Syria like al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, of course, who we know was behind 9/11. So it's an example of where U.S. foreign policy goals, whatever they are, subsume issues like being concerned about working with or abetting al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, this is the real issue that has plagued American foreign policy and what you could call the national security state. I think, you know, people popularly refer to it as a deep state. I think it's fair to call them that, or a permanent war state that's plagued them since the Cold War. In its zeal to bleed the Soviet Union and now it's really about bleeding Russia and Iran. The national security state is completely abrogated. It's what should be its top mission, which is to take on these Sunni jihadist organizations, which have repeatedly attacked soft targets in the West and caused chaos. They should be fighting them. Instead, They're using them as proxies in many cases to bleed Russia in Iran and Syria as well, countries which pose no, which have really no intention to attack the United States, and which are active in the fight against ISIS. So, you know, this took place in Libya. It took place in cooperation with Qatar. The U.S. not only intervened through NATO, through its air force, but it was also funding the rebels through the Libyan National Transition Council. And in Benghazi, it was Abdel Hakim Belhaj, the head of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who was getting the bulk of the arms. The money was going through Qatar, but Qatar was kind of the U.S. proxy for the most effective anti-Qaddafi fighting group. Then you saw what took place in Benghazi around the time that Ambassador Christopher Stevens was killed at the Benghazi consulate. What the hell was he doing there? He was part of the RAT. He was helping to direct the RAT line, which is the transfer of arms from the arms depots that had formerly belonged to Qaddafi's military, now defunct, into Syria. Belhaj was going into Syria to meet with the Free Syrian Army, which was being trained and armed by the U.S. And when you started to see these heavy weapons on the battlefield, that's when the Syrian civil war escalated. A Clinton advisor referred to this in the New York Times as the bank shot, using this kind of sports metaphor. Then the U.S. started using kind of like a series of shell companies through Saudi Arabia to purchase arms from Eastern European arms distributors. TOW missiles, the anti-tank missiles, were coming in by the tens of thousands into the rebels starting in 2013. This is when Operation Timber Sycamore, the CIA's operation, which budgeted one out of every $15 in the agency's budget towards arming and training the rebels, took place. And as we've reported again and again at Alternet, and as others like Gareth Porter have reported, for example, most recently at American Conservative, the arms went straight from the CIA-vetted groups into Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Jabhat al-Nusra would either take over the CIA's weak little FSA proxies, or its fighters would simply join Jabhat al-Nusra because they were better fighters. And now you see on the Syrian battlefield, in places like Jobar, for example, east of Damascus, you'll see al-Qaeda's local affiliate operating with TOW missiles that have been made by Raytheon, the U.S. arms manufacturer, and were shipped in as part of our effort to extend and escalate the Syrian conflict. This is a complete disaster. And then beyond that, Aaron, you have the issue of the disposal problem. This is a problem that the U.S. first experienced after the Bay of Pigs, when it trained Cuban exiles to attack Fidel Castro's revolutionary government and failed. They came back to Miami. They had to give them stuff to do to keep them from returning to militant activity and using those skills and their subterfuge and subversion that they learned against the U.S. government. Time and time again, we have seen since the training of the Afghan Mujahideen, we saw this most recently with the Manchester bombing, that the proxies the U.S. has been using in the Middle East, these Salafi jihadist proxies, have come home to attack their former patrons. And the chickens will come home to roost again and again after what we've done in Syria. We've barely begun to experience the full extent of this catastrophe.
So, Max, you know, it's so interesting to me that Western narratives can be so dominant that everybody, even progressive media, can be swayed by them. And on that point, I want to talk to you about Cy Hirsch, the veteran investigative journalist, Pulitzer Prize winner, broken a number of really important stories, starting with the My Lai massacre back in Vietnam, decades ago. So he reported recently that the Trump administration had ordered its airstrike against the Assad regime back in April, despite warnings from U.S. intelligence that they had no evidence that Assad had carried out the chemical weapons attack in Khan Sheikhoun, which Trump had said was the reason for his bombing. Now, the Hirsch story was totally ignored here in the Western media. And in fact, to publish it, he had to go to Germany. But so he couldn't publish it here, which is one thing. But then even after he reported it, it didn't even get a mention, to such an extent that even a progressive show like Democracy Now!, which I used to work for, didn't even mention it in any of their news items. So it was just striking to me that this claim from this legendary journalist was deemed unworthy of being even mentioned. I mean, I'm not saying you have to endorse what he's saying, but even to mention it was all of a sudden off limits. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, it's pretty clear that what happened in Khan Sheikhoun is bizarre, given the timing of it. 2 days after the Trump administration officially reversed longstanding U.S. policy on encouraging regime change in Syria and declared that Assad would stay, you saw the deployment of apparent deployment of chemical weapons, triggering the red line, and then massive pressure in the media from the Syrian opposition, from all of these forces from the Gulf states for Trump to do something. This should have been the source of public debate, and it should have fallen to places like Democracy Now to fill the void and at least have a debate on what happened, why this is happening, and to explore the wisdom of attacking the Syrian government at this point. But this has really scarcely ever happened at Democracy Now. In my opinion, they've abrogated their mission, which would be to challenge mainstream narratives and particularly imperial narratives on issues like Syria. I understand there are massive human rights abuses by the Syrian government, but that's not reason enough to not explore what the West's agenda and the Gulf agenda is for that country, what the consequences are, to actually get into the geopolitical issues. Instead, we've seen Democracy Now! Propagate generally a regime change narrative. I don't believe they actually have a line on Syria. It's more a fear of actually taking on the official line. I haven't found a single article in The Intercept challenging the regime change line on Syria. I have, however, seen a Puff interview with the former spokesperson for Jabhat al-Nusra inside Syria, someone who is an Australian foreign fighter who is involved in one of the largest financial embezzlement schemes in Australia, where he took something like $40 million in taxpayer money from the Australian government and funneled it into Al-Qaeda in Syria. There was no question about that put to him in The Intercept. And I don't understand how that gets through the editors or why somebody like, for example, Rania Khalik hasn't been called on to just provide the other side of the narrative. So this just hasn't happened in progressive media. It's why we're pushing, why we're trying to fill the void at the Gray Zone Project at Alternet and provide a critical perspective on what the U.S. and its allies have been doing in Syria and what the consequences could be. I think we're probably the only progressive outlet that's consistently doing that. And that, you know, that's, I don't want to attack other outlets that I really, I like the work that The Intercept does. And I've been a frequent guest on Democracy Now! In many ways, I owe them. They've been an institution for almost two decades, and I've learned so much from the work they've done. It's just that we should expect more of them, and we should expect them to challenge the official imperial narrative from that's really emanating from the national security state, not to echo it. And instead, they've generally done the opposite.
Yeah, Max. I mean, I totally share in your sentiment. I worked there for a long time, and I owe them too. It's hands down my favorite news show. I've just been surprised by many of the issues that you've raised.
On the day that Trump attacked Syria, Democracy Now! Hosted Lina Sergiatar, who is basically a lobbyist for the Syrian opposition. Who's been pushing for U.S. military assault on Syria since 2012. I mean, that was just it's absurd. And day after day, they either go without challenging the regime change line or hosting these figures who should be on CNN instead. Progressive media's job is to challenge that narrative, to fill the void. And, you know, in the Trump era, it's just not really happening.
You know, Max, I do want to point out one exception to all this, which I think was very important. There was a very long piece in the New York Times Magazine about a month ago called Aleppo After the Fall. And it was by the veteran Middle East correspondent Robert F. Worth. And he basically presented a picture that totally contradicts the dominant Western narrative that we've seen about Syria. One of the things that he pointed out, and I think it touches on something that you raised, he pointed out that Aleppo, for example, that, you know, few people in the West could properly appreciate just how brutal the jihadis who controlled Aleppo were in the service of pushing their own foreign policy objectives of fighting the Assad regime. But one point he made, and I think it tracks with what you said about the serious abuses of the Assad regime, is that he said that exiled Syrians are so upset by Assad's crimes that they've been unable to acknowledge the crimes of the jihadists. I'm wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, many of them have been part of the opposition for years, and in many ways their political behavior mirrors that of exiled Venezuelans and exiled Cubans in Miami, and they form lobbies to push for regime change. I don't want to generalize all of them. But this, you know, explains those who are officially organized and politically active to a large degree. And, you know, we published a piece by Rania Khalik of interviews of Syrians inside government-held Syria, where 18 million Syrians live, which is something like 80% of the whole population. And there is no group that they have more contempt for than the Syrian expat community that's been out of the country for decades and it's been pushing the U.S. and its allies to bomb the crap out of Syria. But, you know, we have to go back to the time in December. I guess if you're watching this right now, I would just direct you to on Aleppo, a documentary made by a resident of East Aleppo called 9 Days in Aleppo. Just go on YouTube and watch it. It's one of the most remarkable documentaries, it's about 10 minutes long, of the Syrian civil war. And it shows how East Aleppo was taken by hardline Islamist rebels in 2012. He was in his apartment and he's just filming outside his window and showing what's happening. And how first the CIA-vetted Free Syrian Army comes in, they take some territory. Then Liwa al-Tawhid, which later became Nuruddin al-Zenki, a CIA-backed hardcore Islamist militia, which has been responsible for beheadings and all sorts of atrocities, the kidnapping of journalists. They just simply took 5 neighborhoods in East Aleppo. It wasn't like there were protests and then, you know, the protesters had to take up guns to defend themselves. This started with straight up violence. The officers' club in Aleppo was bombed. People were killed in order for the rebels to hold that territory. Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda affiliate, came in. Ahrar al-Sham, a hardcore Salafist militia, came in with backing from Turkey and Qatar, and they held these areas, and about 40,000 people who were mainly sympathizers of the rebels were there, and we were supposed to drop everything we were doing in the United States and display total solidarity for these groups and their supporters, and to believe Samantha Power that the removal of them by the Syrian armed forces and its Russian ally was as bad as Srebrenica and as bad as Rwanda. And now we've seen what really took place and what has been left in its wake. As Robert Wirth from the New York Times kind of reluctantly revealed, which is that, yes, Eastern Aleppo was held by jihadists. Terrorism was used against the population of 1.2 million people in West Aleppo. The removal of these forces was, in fact, by any objective measure, a liberation. And if you said that in December 2016, you'd be branded as an Assadist. But that's what Robert Wirth essentially found when he saw what these jihadist and Salafist forces left behind. And I would just ask any American, you know, who was cheering for the rebels and displaying solidarity with the white helmets in East Aleppo, think about what you would do if you were living in West Aleppo and Al-Qaeda was next door. How would you react?
Yeah, you know, I just want to read a bit of what Wirth writes. He said, "Eastern Aleppo may not have been Raqqa, where ISIS advertised its rigid Islamist dystopia and its mass beheadings. But as a symbol of Syria's future, it was almost as bad. A chaotic wasteland full of feuding militias, some of them radical Islamists, who hoarded food and weapons while the people starved." Max, quickly, as we wrap up this part of the discussion.
Well, that dovetails with what we saw in when Vice actually managed to get access to the rebels in East Aleppo and went to the schools where Al-Qaeda's local affiliate was taking a generation of youth, you know, between ages 5 and 10 and training them in the ways of violent jihad. And it was absolutely shocking. You see circles of children singing, you know, these classic jihadist songs in support of Osama bin Laden, just being indoctrinated day after day after day while and many some of them were from Uzbekistan, and their parents had come to Syria to fight not just against the government, but to fight to establish an Islamic state. That's what was taking place in schools in East Aleppo. And I don't know what people were thinking when they were displaying not only, you know, solidarity, but support for the agenda which had taken hold. We saw a total whitewash of the reality on the ground by every major cable news network. And meanwhile, we're seeing at least the same level, if not more, of atrocities being wielded and against the civilian population in Raqqa, just as we saw in Mosul, by the U.S. coalition. And there's total radio silence from U.S. media. So it was clear what was happening there. The rebels were proxies for the U.S. and its allies, and they were defeated. And that defeat really represented, it should have represented the end of the Syrian civil war, but it represented the major transition point in the Syrian civil war. We're moving towards de-escalation. Refugees are coming home. And I think, you know, from a symbolic perspective, that defeat represented one of the greatest losses for the empire since the fall of Saigon. It's something that many people on the left cried about. I don't understand that.
We'll leave it there. Max Blumenthal, best-selling author, journalist, and senior editor for Alternet's Gray Zone Project. Max, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
لنفكر حاله فرعان أمره عم يمشي هالكون لو جرب يدفر عن هون نكسر إيده لو مدى لنفكر حاله فرعان أمره عم يمشي هالكون لو جرب يدفر عن هون نكسر إيده لو مدى
توجيه الشكر للسورية الأسد لسوريا حافظ الأسد لسوريا بشار الأسد لسوريا الشعب الأبي الصامد لسوريا الجيش العربي المقاوم
سور الشوق سور الغرب جالك سوريا نحنا عالإنجيل وعالكتاب ترابك نحميه احلفنا سور الشوق سور الغرب جالك سوريا نحنا عالإنجيل وعالكتاب ترابك نحميه احلفنا لما تنادي ولادي وين ما بيلحم يغمط لك عين بيلبوك الملايين لو عالموت لما تنادي ولادي وين ما بيلحق يغمض لك عين بيلفوا في الملايين نوع الموت نتحدى
ما في قوة فوق الأرض علينا فيها تتعدى عروش بلادي ما بتنهد وشمسها ما حد بيردى
ويا نقول أنت موجودة في الأرواح في القلوب في العقول في الحاضر في الماضي في المستقبل
صعب الليل نهار يصير غرمان الصحراء تلمع وأصعب يا غاصب بكتير ورد من بلادي تشمع صعب الليل نهار يصير غرمان الصحراء تلمع أصعب يا غاصب بكتير ورد من بلادي تشمع بلادي الكلمة والإيمان ما بترضى زل الطغيان يوم كونها الرحمن قطعا من الجنة عدى بلادي الكلمة والإيمان ما بترضى زل الطغيان يوم كونها الرحمن قطعا من الجنة عدى
ما في قوة فوق الأرض علينا فيها تتعدى عروش بلادي ما بتنهد وشمسها ما حد بيردها
اللي مفكر حاله فرعون بأمره وعم يمشي هالكون لو جرب يدفر عن هون نكسر ايده لو بدا
نكسر ايده لو بدا
الموت لاسرائيل
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was a Syrian army song, No Power Can Overcome Us. And we hear from Max Blumenthal on how the media covers Syria. And of course, you know, back in the USSR, of course, supports the anti-imperialist struggle of the Syrian people against the forces which are tearing that country apart, you know, including the United States, namely the United States and its allies. And we don't really have time to really go in depth, or at least for me to talk about it very in depth. But of course, like really what's been going on over the last year with Trump and the whole Russiagate thing and like the whole, you know, all the conspiracy theories surrounding that and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, the American media is propagating. I also found that Max Blumenthal really did a good job discussing that, too. And basically really analyzing like how basically almost any move towards peace in Syria is seen as like a hostile threat by the U.S. establishment, effectively. And this is really what I want to end on. I'm going to end the show on this. But of course, I'm going to be back next week. Back in the USSR is back to stay, you know. And of course, I'm going to see you all here next week. But I'm going to end on this, and this is Max Blumenthal's analysis of it's called Trump, Putin, Russiagate collide at the G20, and this is an analysis of that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. At their first ever meeting, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin agreed to a ceasefire in southwestern Syria. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson hailed it as a major step forward.
This de-escalation area was agreed. It's well-defined agreements on who will secure this area. A ceasefire has been entered into, and I think this is our first indication of the U.S. and Russia being able to work together in Syria.
Despite that news, U.S. media appeared more interested in another development from the meeting. Tillerson said Trump confronted Putin about Russian meddling in the U.S. election.
They had a very robust and lengthy exchange on the subject. The president pressed President Putin on more than one occasion regarding Russian involvement. President Putin denied such involvement, as I think he has in the past. The two leaders agreed, though, that this is a substantial hindrance in the ability of us to move the Russian-U.S. relationship forward, and agreed to exchange further work regarding commitments of non-interference.
Tillerson also said Putin asked Trump for proof of the alleged Russian interference. So far, the Russiagate affair has relied on the claims of leading Democrats, some U.S. intelligence agencies, and anonymous officials. Joining me is Max Blumenthal, best-selling author, journalist, and senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. Welcome, Max.
Good to be with you.
So, a lot of focus on the on Trump bringing up election meddling with Putin, but it seems like this Syria ceasefire in southwestern Syria is a pretty big deal. Max, your thoughts on this very hyped-up meeting between these two?
Well, I'll start with the alleged ceasefire. I don't know if it's a big deal or not. It's something that should have happened a long time ago. It's happening within the context of these deconfliction zones. And the deconfliction zones have been actually a driver of conflict, at least at the around in eastern Syria, on the border of Iraq, around the Awalid border crossing, near the town of Tanef, where the U.S. has set up this 150-kilometer deconfliction zone. The Russians are very upset about that and believe that it will result in, or it sets the stage for, the federalization of Syria. In other words, the breakup of Syria and the partition of it. Part of the ceasefire plan as it emerges is to leave Assad in power, but we've seen the schizophrenia of the Trump administration on display as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, while cutting this deal, which is clearly a deal that would leave Assad in power. And I don't know who else they think would come in. Like, would it be Jabhat al-Nusra chief Mohammad Jolani? Like, there isn't really a successor. While cutting this deal, he did call for a transition, which sounds like something, you know, from 4 years ago. It sounds really 2000 and late to me. So I don't know what he's talking about. Southwestern Syria has been a place that I've heard think tank experts from, for example, the Middle East Institute in Washington, which is funded by the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and these countries, as a place that would be sort of part of the partition. It would be, you know, not part of, not under the Syrian government control. So I think we have to wait and see what the ceasefire would lead to. But obviously, any kind of ceasefire, any form of de-escalation in the near term is a good thing, because it will lead to less people getting killed. And as we've seen, a UN report that was issued last week found that 440,000 civilians who have been internally displaced by the Syrian civil war, in other words, they've fled from rebel-held areas, areas held by the U.S. and Gulf-funded rebels, into the government areas, have actually been able to return home and reunite with their families because those areas have been retaken from the rebels. So de-escalation is going to actually relieve the refugee crisis. Going, you know, back to the issue of, you know, how the meeting with Putin has been covered. I mean, the U.S. media, there has been some coverage of the details of the negotiations, but very little. We've seen very little detail. I mean, if you're watching this right now, you know, do a cursory Google search and look for details of Trump, the Trump administration's discussion on the Minsk agreement with Putin and Russia. That's the agreement to that should lead to a de-escalation of the conflict in Ukraine. There's very little details the U.S. media is providing. Same with Syria. What we've instead seen is psychobabble about Vladimir Putin and how he will sort of dominate Trump in this meeting. Now, let's assume that Putin is so clever and so nefarious that he's going to dominate Trump. It's very clear that Putin is probably a more competent leader than Trump. I mean, Trump doesn't have a very high foreign policy or diplomatic IQ, and he's clearly a malignant narcissist who operates on receiving approval. Like, I'll go along with all that. Well, let's just assume Putin gets what he wants and they cut a deal. What would that deal would take place? Would it mean that the U.S. would hand over its sovereignty to Russia? That Russia would have more freedom to hack our elections? It's not even clear what would happen. But we've seen the most ridiculous psychobabble. For example, we saw in the New York Times an absurd rumor that Vladimir Putin once brought a black lab to a meeting with Angela Merkel in order to intimidate her because she was supposedly afraid of dogs. I don't know what kind of person, except maybe a bizarre German person would be afraid of a cuddly black lab. But Putin was actually at home in Sochi. The lab was there. He didn't bring it to the meeting. The lab just kind of wandered out. Merkel looked a little bit nervous. And then, you know, I looked online for pictures of Merkel and dogs. And there are lots of pictures of her greeting rescue dogs in Italy, for example, and going up and shaking the dog's paw. Putin denied that he brought the dog to scare Merkel. But this is just reported as fact. And then you see these 5,000 retweets from some NBC producer I've never heard of. Like, this is all you need to know about Vladimir today. Let me give one more example just to show I'm not, you know, nitpicking. The New York Times, I mean, I got to read this. This is awesome. Called on a Russia expert to psychoanalyze Russians in the Russian mind. You know, this is like the racist stuff we saw about Arabs and Muslims after 9/11, as we were going into the Middle East for the forever war. His name is William Taubman, and he does appear to be some expert in Soviet history. Here's the insight he provided. When they get drunk, Russians will often say, "You respect me, don't you?" That was his quote in the New York Times. This is how we're supposed to understand the Putin-Trump meeting. I mean, this is absurd. And it's what led to the, you know, the display, the juvenile adolescent display by the U.S. press before Lavrov and Tillerson, where all they could think about was Russian meddling. And what was Lavrov going to say? What was he going to say? So this is just the quality of the media we're getting. It's actually very much reminds Russians I know, who are liberal Russians who are, you know, not very friendly to Putin, of the kind of media they see back home, of the domestic propaganda they get.
Yeah, Max, you mentioned the New York Times, so I just have to point out that this is the same New York Times that recently published Louise Mensch, this conspiracy theorist who's contributions to the Russiagate affair include suggesting that Putin was behind the protests in Ferguson. But, you know, I want to get back to Syria because you mentioned Russia.
Can I interrupt real quickly?
All right, but then we're going back to Syria. Go ahead.
There's a guy named Clint Watts, who's a former FBI agent. He's all over CNN and MSNBC. He's been in the Daily Beast. The Guardian quoted him yesterday.
He testified before Congress.
He testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee that Russia was behind Black Lives Matter. Okay, so these nutcases are still out there. These Mensheviks are still out there, and nobody cares about that. And Louise Mensch is not a bad apple. You have a whole crew of Mensheviks who are pumping their toxicity into the suggestible brains of elite liberals.
There's a lot to talk about Russiagate, but just staying with Syria for a second, you mentioned the deconfliction zones, and I just want to clarify for people who aren't familiar with that what that is. So that is the a zone that the U.S.-led coalition has established inside Syria, and they've used these zones to actually fire recently on Syrian forces and Iranian-backed proxies. And so are you saying that the this record here and the fact that the U.S. has used these deconfliction zones to fire on Syria and its allies as grounds to be skeptical of this new ceasefire agreement between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, it's allowed for a de facto U.S. base in eastern Syria. And Colin Kahl, who is a former advisor to Joe Biden and was in Barack Obama's National Security Council, I think. Not exactly. This isn't, Noam Chomsky or even like, someone even crazier like Max Blumenthal talking. But he said that we've established an Alamo in eastern Syria that we will have to defend. It's a terrible idea and will only lead to escalation. I think I even saw John Podesta criticize this idea. Someone whose Podesta group just took up a $1.7 million contract with the Saudi Arabian government to lobby for them. So it's not like it's a sort of, far left anti-imperial, that criticism of this is limited to the left. I mean, this is clearly a bad idea, but it's what the Trump administration is doing to establish leverage with Russia at least the U.S. moves towards a kind of partition. Now, the most dangerous area that I don't think we're discussing, there isn't much discussion. If you want to read analysis of that deconfliction zone, we covered it at the Gray Zone Project at Alternate, analyzed it. Ben Norton wrote a great analysis for us. But the issue of Raqqa this is going to be a huge problem if we don't understand what the U.S. agenda is for Raqqa and for the towns around it. Raqqa is an Arab city. It is a Syrian Arab city. Its interior is still partly controlled by ISIS. They're going to be ousted by the Syrian Defense Forces, which is armed and trained by the U.S. It's a mostly Kurdish militia, which is now kind of acting as an arm of American power in eastern Syria. When ISIS is removed, what happens to the Arab residents of Raqqa when a mostly Kurdish force moves in? The U.S. seems to be indicating that the Syrian government will not be allowed to take control of Raqqa. Brett McGurk who's the head of the U.S. coalition against ISIS, has already taken tours of towns near Raqqa, which have been captured. And those towns are not able to pay their teachers. Their electricity hasn't come on. And it's because of the U.S. deconfliction line. It will not allow the Syrian government to restore control. And so people there are suffering. I spoke to someone who I would describe as close to the Kurdistan Regional Authority some weeks ago. And that person told me that the residents of Raqqa will, quote unquote, decamp. Will the Arab residents of Raqqa, the Sunni Arab residents of Raqqa, be ethnically cleansed by a mostly Kurdish force under U.S. control to prevent the Syrian government from reestablishing its authority in eastern Syria? That sounds like a terrible scenario to me and something very dangerous as we move forward in Syria, and also something that anyone who's remotely concerned with human rights should be worried about, along with the weapons and the mass civilian casualties the U.S. is causing there already.
Well, Max, let me ask you on the point of the Kurds. I mean, do they have a record inside Syria to suggest that that possibility might happen? And haven't they said or, you know, taken great pains to stress many times that they don't have designs on territory beyond what they already control in northern Syria?
No, there's no record of it in Rojava or Manbij and these areas. These are, you know, Kurdish areas, but now they're moving beyond, they're moving outside areas that are Kurdish. The U.S. is pushing them to do so. What happens? Who holds the deconfliction line for the U.S.? What if the people of Raqqa have a different idea in mind? What if the teachers and the public employees want their salaries restored? Brett McGurk told the New York Times, this is the head of the U.S. coalition against ISIS, that while the U.S. intended to provide chalkboards and desks in this area, it was basically going to turn to the UN for everything else and displace all responsibility for the civilian population onto the UN to avoid allowing Syria to take control back of Syria. This is, you know, not only classic imperialism, something that Russia is not doing in Syria because Russia is returning territory to the Syrian government. It is a recipe for complete disaster and more human catastrophe.
So, Max, in terms of how Putin and Trump are discussed here in the U.S., I want to play for you a clip from today. This is the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper, being interviewed by Andrea Mitchell of MSNBC.
If President Trump does not raise the issue of Russian hacking, Russian meddling in our election, what's the impact?
Well, I think one thing is that Putin will be even more emboldened to continue their activities. And looking ahead to 2018-2020 elections, they're going to be more aggressive about it. In fact, the reports that came out yesterday about increased Soviet or Freudian slip, Russian collection activity in this country, which I think is probably part of this, and is he's simply
they're sending more spies here.
Exactly.
Max, so that's James Clapper and Andrea Mitchell. And what I found interesting there was we're not just talking now about 2016 and how Russia helped Trump win through their fake news and hacked emails, but now they're talking about sending more spies to the U.S. And the discussion I'm seeing now is how this is going to influence the next elections and how we all have to get ready.
Well, first of all, this is James Clapper, who lied under oath to Congress and has twice said in recent weeks that he believes that Russians are genetically primed to interfere in foreign countries, that they're genetically primed to subvert. You know, this is the language we'd expect from someone maybe titled Obergruppenführer Clapper. But it's not any language that betrays an objective analysis of Russian goals or the Russian geopolitical agenda. We heard a lot of hysteria. I guess it was somewhat justified. We heard a lot of outrage about statements Trump made in Poland about Western civilization being under attack from without and from within by subversion. He even used the term subversion, this being kind of classic fascist rhetoric. And, you know, it does sound like a lot of the neo-fascists in Europe, but it also sounds a lot like the liberals. And if you browse the headlines at the Daily Beast, I mean, I just did a quick browse, you'll see headlines warning that Russia aims to subvert the entire West from within. And you'll hear rhetoric like Clapper's about the genetic tendencies of Russians. So there's a hysteria on the other side by Trump's opponents about subversion of the West from without and from within. And in many ways, it's unfounded. I don't believe that Russia has the ability to subvert a democracy that's already in deep decline. It does have the ability to allow us to project our internal contradictions and our problems onto a foreign country. Clapper was referring in that report to completely anonymously sourced CNN report about ramped up Russian spy activity. I don't know if that means that Russian spies are taking Adderall now or that there are more Russian spies, but when CNN reported it, it was sourced entirely to anonymous intelligence officials, anonymous senior intelligence official. So whatever anonymous intelligence officials say, CNN believes, and the opponents of Trump swallow it poll.
You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.